Let's get started. Today, we'll continue about the talk about quantitative research, and we will be discussing measurement. But before that, let's talk about some of the very basics. So, So, what is correlation? Do you all know what correlation means? What is correlation? So, who doesn't know what correlation means? Who knows what correlation means? Raise your hand. Who wants to answer what does correlation mean? Okay, should I pick somebody? Everyone knows what a correlation is. Who wants to try? Okay, so no one no one has the courage. So correlation is one of the basic things that we use in quantitative research. Correlation is the measure of linear dependency between two variables. And here we can see that our correlation of one basically means that when one observation increases by X, another observation always increases by Y. So one observation can be expressed as a linear function of another observation, another variable. So two variables are completely dependent on one another. If you know one, then you will know the other one. And zero correlation means that there is no pattern between two variables. And then between one and zero, we have different patterns, 0.8. The variables are highly related, 0.4 less related, and negative association means that when one increases, another one goes down. Then also, correlation does not tell us what is the slope of the dependency. So we may have a strong correlation that just one, let's say that x is one variable, y is other variable. If we define that y is always half of x, then we have a line like that. If we define that y is always twice x, then we have a line of that. Both are perfectly correlated. And correlation here is zero, so correlation does not mean, lack of correlation does not mean that there is no pattern in data. It just means that there is no linear pattern in the data. We do most of our analysis based on correlations of course, we have more refined techniques, but most techniques, if you know the correlations, then you will know the end result of your whatever analysis you want to do. So understanding what correlation is one of the basics, and I'm really happy that most of you knew it already. So let's talk about the structure of what we have done before and what's going to be ahead of us for the next three lectures. We talked about research design and inference last time. And now we will be discussing measurement. So to do quantitative research, we must quantify things. And the process of quantification is called measurement. So we have people who are different heights here, for example. We have to be able to set numbers to your heights to be able to do calculations on those heights. That's one of the that's measurement. Then next Thursday, or this Thursday, we'll talk about regression analysis, which is the workhorse in quantitative research, and then on next Monday we'll talk about how do you actually do this in practice. So I'll be showing you a demonstration of how to test the hypothesis. Let's review quickly what we did last time. We spent some time with the example of these 500 largest Finnish companies in 2005. There was an observation, a fact, that the women-led companies were 4.7 percentage points more profitable than the men-led companies. That's a big difference, and it made news in 2005 summer. And what we were asking is, what does this difference actually mean? What can we say based on the difference? And the fact is, the data are that at one point of time, in one sample of companies, the companies led by women were more profitable. The question is, where does it generalize? What kind of inferences can we make from this fact? And the first question is this generalizable over years, or is it just a unique thing that happened to happen that year, and other years there's no difference. Also, another thing, does it generalize to other firms? So if we know something about the largest 500 Finnish companies, would it generalize to the next 500 largest companies? So would it generalize to the 1,000 largest companies? Would it generalize to small startups? And knowing that kind of thing helps us to understand what we can do with the data. Then we talked about the roles of statistics and which role we need. So in statistical analysis and quantitative research, the simplest level is description. We just state the fact. Sometimes that is enough. For example, if we have a fact that 70% of the students fail the first time they take the exam of this class, that will tell something valuable for the students. They underestimate how much they need to study, and or it may tell something for the course staff. Maybe our exam is too challenging for the students. The next step is prediction. So when you know the relationship between two variables, then you can predict outcomes. For example, if we know when an apartment is built, where it's located and how large it is, we can predict what the sales price is going to be. And I'm going to show you how to do it, because it can possibly save you lots of money if you know how to predict a sales price, because then you can make more informed bids when you're buying something. And the next stage is explanation. So prediction simply means that there's some regularity that we can use to infer that when one variable is large, another one is large as well. Then we go to explanation, and explanation adds the concept of causality. And that means that if we know one variable is a cause of another variable, then we can actually say that if you do something, then something will happen. For example, naming a woman as a CEO will make the company more profitable. So that is a lot stronger form of argumentation than simply being able to predict. Then we have another variant, which is causal explanation, which is still stronger, and causal explanation requires that you not only demonstrate that there is causality, but you also explain why. So you explain the causal process. For example, women are more socially talented, therefore the companies that they lead will have better management teams, therefore the companies will be more profitable. Something like that. Then we talked about ruling out chance as an explanation, and the main tool for that is null hypothesis significance testing. You may not encounter the term when you read research, but you encounter the p-value. So p-value is a way to quantify how certain we are that there is a difference, or there is a correlation, there is an effect in the population when we observe something in a sample. We had an example of you trying to foresee what the two dice were, and the null hypothesis here is that no one is clairvoyant. You wouldn't have known in advance what the dice are, and the odds for answering this correctly by guessing is 1 out of 36. So it's less than 5%. If you have it correctly, it means that you are clairvoyant with a p-value of less than 0.05, which is the commonly used cutoff for statistical significance in information systems research. Of course, we have two options when we have a small p-value. One is that we need a type 1 statistical error, which means that we are falsely saying that something exists when in fact it doesn't. Another alternative is that we are correctly assessing that, yeah, you are a clairvoyant person. So I would bet my money that we got lots of false positives last time. Then for those who did not get it correctly, we either committed a type 2 statistical error, which means that our test failed to detect that you were clairvoyant, or you really were not clairvoyant and the test showed that. We never know. Maybe we have some clairvoyant people who just decided to cheat. So this is the idea. We have a null hypothesis which states that there's no effect, and if we observe something that would be unlikely, If there really is no effect, then we infer that maybe there is something. So it's not a very strong form of inference, but that's what's commonly used because it's very simple to do. There is actually the clairvoyance thing. There's actually a paper about it. And in 2001, this one prominent psychologist published a paper where he did 9 experiments where he demonstrated clairvoyance with p-values of 0.05 and something like that. And then that caused some discussion of whether we should do something else than these p-values because they're so easy to misinterpret. Then we talked a bit about what is theory. So when you have causal explanation, you must explain why there's a causal relationship. And the explanation of what happens, how, when, and why is theory. So theory is not the opposite of practice in academic language. Theory is an explanation for a phenomenon. And then practice is something else. The important part of theory is why. And when I guide research projects or master theses or whatever studies, the why part is always the most challenging part. Like people can argue that something causes something and they can demonstrate association with statistics. That's fairly simple, but coming up with an explanation of why is the important part, and that's the difficult part. We talked also how do you demonstrate causality in quantitative research. We have 3 conditions for causality, demonstrating causality. If X causes Y, then we have to demonstrate that X is associated with Y. The association may be a correlation, or it may be some other kind of statistical association. Then we must demonstrate that X precedes Y, not Y precedes X. So we have these direction that we have to demonstrate. And then we have to eliminate rival explanations. The directionality is easy to do. You just measure the cause before the effect. Take the zero gender last year, take profitability this year. If there is a trend that way, then it's quite unlikely that it's actually this year's profitability causing the gender of the CEO last year, because time doesn't work that way. Elimination of rival explanation is more complicated. We have 2 strategies. One is an experiment. So in experimental studies, we have 2 groups, or at least 2 groups. One is control group, one is treatment group. So we divide our data or our participants into 2 groups. One receives the treatment, another one doesn't. Then we measure an outcome. If there's a difference between the outcomes between the groups, then the only reason for that difference is that our treatment did something. This is how medicines are tested. So, for example, new surgical procedures, they test by going so far that they actually take the control group and they take those into the operating room. They actually put those into anesthesia, open them up, and then close them without doing this actual surgery. So you try to do control and treatment as close as possible, and then just one receives treatment, other one doesn't. Experiments are difficult to do because of limitations. Like if you do organizational level studies, you study the implementation of information system projects. If a project implementation costs, let's say, 10 million euros, or 1 million euros even, then no organization will want to participate in an experiment where you randomize something because they want to be certain that they get the best possible project. Okay, so that is in a nutshell what we talked about last class. And now we will talk more about how do we establish association. So to establish that 2 things have a statistical association, we must first have some scores or data for those 2 things. For example, and the problem is that in research, many of the things that we want to study don't really have numbers attached to them. So if we talk about the success of an information systems development project, we can't really say that one is a 9, another one is a 4. It doesn't have a number. So how do we quantify something that is not readily quantifiable? And that is for you to talk about now. So form groups of 3 to 5 people and think about it. How do you measure the success of an information systems development project? And let's see what you can come up with. Okay, which group wants to share their ideas first? How do you measure information systems development project success? Okay, so I'll give you the microphone because someone watch the videos, and they wanted us to use the microphone for the students as well, so that we can have the answers.
Okay, no. So yes, we had one explanation that deals with the money used on the development project compared to the degree of it's being ready.
So you have the like how much we got for a euro. So
yes,
how much quality.
Yes.
That's a good one. Anyone? What other ideas? Anyone else? Are you afraid of the microphone? Just relay the microphone back.
I'm here. So, at first, we need to measure a lot of things because money is one thing. But, for example, how satisfied the management is for the system and how satisfied are the employees using it.
So, how would you measure it?
Yeah, so, of course, how to measure the satisfaction and, of course, time, when to measure it at when the system is ready, then measure it, and also 2 years from that you need to measure it because it changes. So you can't dictate the project to be successful if you measure at one point, because usually those are big systems and it takes time to and it changes the satisfaction of the system.
Yeah. Would you use a questionnaire for measuring satisfaction or something else?
Yeah, that's one thing also, but I don't know. Those customers, they might not be the best one, but also, for example, you can see the hard data from the company. For example, how much people, employees, basically resigned before in a year, and how many people resigned after the project. So maybe that tells something about the satisfaction of their work.
Yeah, so that is two ways to measure. So people are so upset that they leave the company. Measure the number of persons who left and then just ask their opinions. Both are valid ways of measuring the information systems like satisfaction. I would say questionnaires probably are at least 100 times more common than seeing who left. I'll give you this one.
I don't know if this is a good measurement technique, but still I was thinking that maybe we can use the system data so that we know that what the opinions are, what they are actually doing with the system. So that tells us something about is it successful or not, but it depends. Of course, we have to know what the goals were. So maybe if we get the system data and then use the goals and then measure it, I don't know.
That's a really good answer. So do people actually use the system? If the people are not using the system, then the system doesn't fill its purpose, and probably people don't use it either because they don't find the system useful, or maybe they find that the system are difficult to use. In either case, the quality of the system is not as high as we would like it to be. And using logs to measure that, it has been done. It's not as common as a questionnaire because getting access to logs is a lot harder than just mailing 1,000 questions all over the world. Anyone else? Any other ideas? So, yeah, pass the microphone, please.
I've been in a couple of development projects in forest-based industries, and it's remarkable that the time one takes to when we can measure the logging in and logging out time, the faster the end user can put the information in, the happier he or she is. It's the correlation is astounding. For example, like people over 50 or over 60, which are not like native in the digital world.
Yeah. So you mentioned that the time that the person takes in the system measured between the login and logout time and satisfaction are correlated. How do you measure the satisfaction to get the correlation?
Well, there were interviews from the McKinsey or whatever consult company did it. But well, they had their own cow in the field, of course, in that.
So you were asking people how satisfied they are.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, can you mute the microphone? We'll talk a bit more about that now. So how many of you read the chapter about measurement from Singleton and Straits before the class? A few. Yeah, that's nice. So what is the first thing that they discussed in the measurement chapter? Do you remember? Before you even start to think about what kind of scales do you use for measurement? No, that was before, in the level of measurement was chronologically before the actual measurement process in the chapter, if I recall correctly. But when they talk about the measurement process, what is the first step in the measurement process?
Conceptualization.
The answer was conceptualization, yeah. And that's very important. So when you start measuring something, the step zero is that you really have to think hard. What is it that you want to measure? And now we talked about quality, we talked about money, and there is also time aspect. So information systems implementation projects are typically thought about as the success is thought on three different dimensions. And now my question is, if we have scope, what is the quality? Did we get all the features that we wanted to have? So on. We have the budget. So did we stay in budget? How much did it cost? And did we stay on schedule? Does it make sense to try to quantify those three as one score? No, because if you say that that one project scores, let's say 5 in being on time and 1 in the 2 other dimensions, and another project scores 5 in being budget and 1 on those 2 other dimensions. So are those projects equally successful? The total sum is 7 for both. No, it depends on what is important for your organization. So what you measure depends on what you need to know. Sometimes it's useful to just have some kind of high-level abstraction like how well you know quantitative research, how well you know qualitative research, how well you know constructive research are three different sets of skills. Still at the course, we find it useful to just give you one score that measures your level of skill on these three different dimensions. If you go on and be a researcher, then it's much more important that you're very good at one than being average on all of those. So it depends on what is the purpose of measurement. And that is the first part that you have to think through. And yeah, Singleton and Straits talk about conceptualization. What is the concept that you want to measure? Does it have different dimensions? If it does, which dimension are you interested in? The scope, of course, here would have 2 different dimensions at least. Did you get all the features? And is the quality on the desirable level? Of course, the quality depends also. If you have a system that is for entertainment, you can there can be some bugs and crashes. It doesn't matter. If it's a banking system or if it's a medical system, then it simply cannot crash because that would mean huge losses or even loss of life. Depends on what you want to have. Then how measurement relates to the bigger picture. So the bigger picture in quantitative research is that we have theoretical concepts that we want to make statements about, causal claims. And those causal claims are called propositions. We talked about this a bit last time. Then we have empirical concepts, and then we have some measurement results. Going back to the CEO performance example, we have CEO gender, which is the theoretical variable. How do we measure CEO gender? It's probably not practical to get a medical explanation of each CEO that we want to study. So how do we measure? Yes, we have a nominal variable receiving 1 if it's a male, 0 if it's a woman, or the other way around. But how do we get to that variable? The measurement is about how do we get from our concept to numbers. How would you... if I gave you the list of CEOs of largest 500 companies, how would you figure out who is a man and who is a woman? Say again?
You ask them that, are you a woman or...
Well, you can ask them, yeah, are you a man or a woman? That would work. There's even... But I probably wouldn't do that. Check the names, that's true. So we have the empirical concept here for the CEO gender would be the CEO's, if the CEO's first name is a man's name. That, of course, is not bulletproof because in some languages, one name is a man's name. In other languages, it's a women's name. Kari is in Finnish, it's a man's name. In American English, it's a women's name. Robin in British English is a man's name. In American English, it's a woman's name. And then you have these Asian people's names who I don't even know. So it's not a bulletproof, but it's good enough. So we have to think when we measure something, what is the cost of measurement? We could get bulletproof data by having all CEOs go through medical expenses. That would be really expensive. If we get the 95% answer, just by looking at the names, that's what we're going to do. Then the measurement result is actually, well, we got the names of CEOs of some specific companies. So the empirical concept is about how do we get the data, and then we have the measurement result, which is actually data that we'll deal with. Then performance we talked about. So the theory is that gender affects performance. Then we used return on assets as the empirical concept, and then specific data for specific companies was the measurement result. Then we deduce. If there is a proposition, if there's a relationship between gender and performance, we should be also observing that a hypothesis between empirical concept and another empirical concept holds, and also that there is a statistical association between our two measurement results. So the idea is that we go from down, from up, back to down. Now, the hard part here is not getting the data. So if we know that we want to have the return on assets on different companies, or we know that we want to have answers to five questions about customer satisfaction, then we just go and get the data from database, or we go and we do a survey. That's not the hard part. The hard part is justifying the relationship between the theoretical concept and the empirical concept. That we actually, the data that we actually have measures the concepts that we want to measure. That's the hard part. One of you mentioned the levels of measurement, so that's final thing in the introduction. We can have different kinds of data. Our data can be in the form of a classification. We talked about, then we say it's a nominal variable. For example, we may have a variable called country or organization. We can say that Finland, Sweden, and Denmark are different countries. We cannot say that Finland is more than Sweden or Denmark. So the variables, the categories, don't have an order. That's a nominal variable. Then we have an ordinal variable, which means an ordered category. For example, if you're answering to a question, whether you agree on a statement from scale from 1 to 5, we know that 1 is smaller than 5, but we don't necessarily know that the difference between 1 and 2 would be the same than between 2 and 3. So that is ordinal measurement. Then interval measurement would be when we have a scale of 1 to 5 and you assume that the difference between 1 and 2 is the same as 2 and 3. We normally have to assume interval level data. So even if our data are not interval, we make an assumption that they are. And then finally, ratio at 0 point, and that's not normally very useful information. So what are characteristics of good measurement? Some characteristics. Repeatability, let's use another term for repeat. Repeatability basically means that if you measure the same thing, again, you will get the same result, right? And we have a term for that, it's called reliability. So repeatability and reliability are the same thing. What else? Validity, what does validity mean? Yeah, it's oikein in Finnish, yeah. But anyway, validity means that the variable, the data that we have, actually measures the thing that we wanted to measure. Then the final thing is whether it's a practical way of measurement. getting CEOs to go through medical examinations to get their genders, it's not practical because we could use the CEO names as well. So we have the two most important parts if we think about the hierarchy of how do you make high quality quantitative research is that we have reliability and measurement validity. If we measure the same thing again, we will get the same results, the replicability. And then measurement validity, do we actually... does the data actually reflect the thing that we want to measure? The measurement validity is sometimes referred to as construct validity in the research, but I don't like the term because the term construct validity originally was used for a particular purpose. Reliability and validity are quite often conceptual or presented as a target practice. So we have reliability, we get always the same result over and over. It doesn't mean that the result is correct. So we get a small set of holes that are not very scattered, but the holes may not be on the bullseye. Then validity is like accuracy. Are the hits on the bullseye on average, but the hits can still be scattered around. So we may have unreliable data that is still valid, and we may have reliable data that is invalid. Which one is more useful? One way to think about the question is that if you had the choice of putting yourself in front of the bullseye on one of these targets, which one would you choose? I think most would choose to have the invalid guy. So if you have reliable measurement that is not valid, then it's not useful. The example that I like to use is measuring intelligence by measuring the circumference of your head with a measurement tape. Seems plausible, the bigger your head, the bigger your brain, then the larger your IQ. It doesn't really correlate with IQ at all, but it's highly repeatable. If you measure my head now and you measure it tomorrow, it's going to be the same. It depends on if I have a haircut in between, then it may be a bit off, but it's about the same. But it doesn't measure the thing IQ. Then unreliable measurement, think about like a wiggling child that you put on a weight scale. The readings will be slightly off because the child doesn't stay still. So I got some experience on that. And how do we make unreliable measurement better? If you have a child who doesn't want to be weighted, so you put him on a scale and he wiggles and you see the scale registers between 10 and 12 kilos, and then you just note one number. And how do you make it more reliable? You can't eliminate. You could sedate the child, yeah, but let's say you can't. So the child will wiggle and your scale will be always slightly off. How do you make it better?
You can repeat and take averages.
Yeah, sure. That's what we do. If we have unreliable data, then we measure multiple times, we take average, and that's more reliable than any of the individual measurements. So reliability can be improved by taking an average of multiple measurements. Okay, we'll skip that. The problem in validity, reliability is easy. You just repeat over and over and over, you average, you get more reliable score. The problem of validity is more difficult, and it's even more difficult because if you read our research manuals, they have this long list of terms about validity. My recommendation is that don't even try to memorize what all these mean and don't even try to understand what these mean. You have to try to understand the idea behind validity rather than what these specific terms mean. The idea of validity is that we have some kind of construct or some kind of concept and we have some kind of observed data that we think measures the construct. And the observed data is also contaminated with some kind of measurement error. If there was no measurement error, then that would mean that our data are equal to the construct and we would have perfect measurement. we can have nearly perfect measurement. For example, if I ask your birth year, I can measure your age pretty accurately, almost without no error. If I ask how old you are, then I actually will get a slightly more error, because older people don't remember their age that often. The idea of validity is that a test is valid for an attribute if and only if the thing that we want to measure exists and the variations in whatever we're measuring cause variations in the data. That is very simple. That's the only definition of validity, the only term that you have to remember. The hard part is not understanding what validity means, but it's how do you actually demonstrate validity in empirical research. That brings us to the practice. So I asked you to skim through the empirical paper by Venkatesh, and that's a very typical example of an information systems research article. And they do survey data, so they send questionnaires, they get answers, they analyze them in different ways. And I would say more than half of IS research are that kind of studies. So you send questionnaires, you get data back, and then they have the questionnaire in Appendix B. Or Appendix A and Appendix B, they had some statistics. So Appendix A, they had the questions, and they had accuracy and completeness and many other concepts that they measured. So they were measuring information system accuracy, information system, information completeness. And they measured them with statements. So they had three statements on which the informants were asked to rate from 1, disagree, to 5, agree. And then 3, no opinion, and so on. Why do they have multiple questions? Has anyone ever you wondered when you fill out a questionnaire, a survey form, that why are they asking the same thing over and over with a little bit of different wording? No one has ever noticed that when you fill in a customer satisfaction survey, they ask whether the food was good today, whether it was good yesterday, whether the food is good in general in the cafeteria. Yeah, so the idea is that we are taking multiple measurements. Of course, that is highly ideal because these are not that independent because they are on the same questionnaire. The idea is that you have some measures that are a bit unreliable. So it may depend on your mood, for example, whether you like to answer 5 or 4. And then when you take multiple measures and you average, you get more reliable. So you can create a composite item, composite scale, we call it an index or scale or composite, by taking a sum of multiple, average of multiple independent measurements. Then also another thing is that the degree to which these different questions are correlated can be used to assess how reliable the scale is. This is exactly what the Venkatesh and colleagues paper does. So they tell us in the beginning of the measurement paragraph that they are average responses to the relevant items to create a score for each variable. That's what we do. We ask multiple questions, we take a mean, or we take a sum, depending. It doesn't really matter. Then they also tell that they utilize the fact that we can use the intercorrelations between our data, our measures, our items, to assess reliability. So they're saying that they use something called Cronbach's alpha and composite reliabilities, which are basically measures of correlations. And then they use that as evidence of reliability. Now, when we have multiple questions, it is important that those questions all measure the same thing. Some people think that it is useful to measure two different things and then combine those as one index. I'm not one of those people, and the reason is this. So let's think that we have a person's size is our construct. We want to measure person's size. We think that the person's size, the most salient variables are person's height in centimeters and weight in kilos. So those are the two most salient data points that we can get. Then we define a variable that is a sum of height and weight. So we are summing variables that measure two different dimensions of the concept. So my size is about 250. What does it really tell about me? So should I eat more, eat less, exercise more? Am I a long-distance runner? Am I tall? What kind of pants should I buy? So that kind of measure, when you combine things that are not measuring the same exact thing, then the variable is conceptually, it's ambiguous. We can't say much. So you have to first establish that your variables measure the same thing before you take a sum. That relates to our example. If you ask three questions, one about whether the project was completed on budget, on time, and whether the project delivers what it was supposed to deliver. You have five questions measuring three different dimensions of information, project systems, project implementation success. You take a sum of those dimensions. The eventual variable, it's hard to interpret. It's better to keep those variables as separate. That brings us to convergent and discriminant validity. So, and that is also what the Venkatesh paper discusses. So convergent validity, this is one of the few validity terms that I think are generally useful. So convergent validity refers to whether indicators or data, variables that are supposed to measure one thing actually measure that thing. And then a related term is discriminant validity, whether the data measures that thing and that thing only. So when we weight a child, the number measures the child on the scale, measures the child's weight. It doesn't measure the child's height. So you have to show that your measures actually are not contaminated with something else. If we have the sum of your height and the sum height and weight as a bound variable, that variable is not discriminant valid because it measures two different things. That's the problem of summing things. And the paper says that they test the convergent discriminant validity of the scales, and they talk that they used factor analysis for that purpose. And factor analysis is the tool for doing that. So this is the first, actually, analysis technique that I'll be discussing in the class. I'll be demonstrating factor analysis next Monday. So the idea of factor analysis is that you take a number of variables, and then the factor analysis answers the question, what do these variables have in common? So it seeks the number of underlying factors that explain the data. The idea, of course, is that the variables are correlated because they measure the same thing. The factor analysis comes in two variants, exploratory factor analysis, where you just give computer your data, and you ask the computer to tell you which factors it can identify from the data. And then confirmatory analysis, where you say that I think these variables measure five different things. Test that for me. So that's confirmatory factor analysis. Exploratory factor analysis is easier to apply, and for your master's thesis, I recommend that you go that road instead of confirmatory factor analysis. If you really want to do confirmatory factor analysis, then you can come to talk to me, and we'll figure it out together. So what does the factor analysis result? I'm not going to talk about what it actually does mathematically, but what does the end result look like? So the end result looks like this. So this is from the paper, table B2. So you get this kind of called factor pattern matrix, and the idea is that you have your variables here on the rows, and then you have the factors on the columns. And this bolding here it's a convention. It aids interpretation because we can see what is the highest factor loading. The idea is that we have these underlying 11 factors that explain data on these 11 scales here, which is what we like to have. And the loadings here should be below about 0.7 for the factor that the indicator is supposed to measure. And that is evidence of convergent validity. If two items load on the same factor, it means that they may measure the same thing. And then the indicator should not load highly on the other factors. That is evidence of discriminant validity. They should be measuring the thing that we want to measure, and only that thing, not something else. Here we can see that other loadings are very small. So these are 0.7 and these are 0.0 something. So we have convergent validity and discriminant validity demonstrated in this table. So why do they get these nice results? The reason is that they're using measurement scales that have been validated over time and shown to actually perform well. So if something has been shown to perform well in 10 studies, then using it is a pretty safe option. Then this is an exploratory factor analysis. So you ask computer to give you a factor solution. A confirmatory factor analysis would mean that you say that only these bolded loadings are allowed, others are zero. And then the computer will test if that is true in the data. Factor analysis tells us that if multiple indicators load on the same factor, they may measure the same thing. Factor analysis doesn't tell you that the thing that the indicators measure is the thing that you want them to measure. Then you just have to be looking at what are the indicators actually like. So what are the questions? If we have questions of success, then those questions probably don't measure, for example, expenditures. And this is used to do convergent and discriminant validity tests. Now, how factor analysis works is that exploratory factor analysis, it first takes all your data, and then it finds one factor that explains the data as well as possible. Then that part of the data of the variance in the data is removed, and we repeat. We find another factor that explains the remaining data as well as possible. We take that variation away from the data, we do a third factor, and so on, until we get the number of factors that we want to have. The problem with that is that if we have these, let's say, two people here with six questions, so we can see that there is some kind of relationship between the questions. So if a person answers, so this is the answer of person two, and this is the answer of person one here. We can see that item 4, 5, and 6 are correlated, and item 1, 2, and 3 are correlated. The factor analysis basically, when you take the first factor, it tries to explain as much variance in data as possible. I'm going to come to a point pretty soon. So we have this factor. The factor says that all items are on this direction from 0. Then we take that variation away, and the second factor is orthogonal to the first factor. The problem with that is that the first factor explains where the data are, and the second factor tells the remaining information. So you can be these two factors, you can completely locate either of the or any of the variables. The problem is that doesn't really show where the data are. We would rather have that we have one factor that points to these three items, another factor that points to these three items, because that's the way we want to have it. What we do after factor analysis, we do a thing called factor rotation, which means that we reorient the factor solution so that the factors point to the items. The items load highly on one factor, and the factor loadings on secondary factor should be low. That is what factor rotation does. And then you can also tweak it by removing the orthogonality constraint here, so you can have these factors pointing to the items. And then we can actually say that, okay, the first factor is the first three items, the second factor is the items 4 to 6. So you get a result that is more interpretable. The reason why this is important to know is that when you do a factor analysis, you have to specify the factor rotation yourself. And you should never use the default alternative. The default is to take uncorrelated factors, which is something that you don't want. And you should use, whenever possible, use Oplimin rotation, and that is actually what these guys did in the paper. That's a technicality, but you have to remember to set the rotation, because otherwise you will get the factor analysis result that is nonsensical. Then we have another analysis technique that is related to factor analysis, which is called principal component analysis. And principal component analysis is not useful when you assess measurement. It's useful for data summarization, but for measurement assessment, you can't use it to assess dimensionality, discriminant validity, or convergent validity. It doesn't do that. People still use it very often for that purpose. The reason is that when you take SPSS, which is one of the more well-known statistical software, and you ask it to do a factor analysis, the default is that it does you a principal component analysis. So people go with the software defaults even if they make no sense whatsoever. Principal component analysis, there's one thing that you should know. Don't use it. Then we have, when you have established that five things or three things may measure, items may measure the same thing, then we have one more statistical tool that we can use called Cronbach's alpha. Basically, Cronbach's alpha is a measure of reliability. If we take a sum of indicators, how reliable that sum is going to be. That's what alpha does, tells you. The computer will calculate it for you. So when you demonstrate measurement, that your measurements are possibly valid and reliable, you do two things. You do a factor analysis, and then you calculate Cronbach's alpha. Why it works is beyond this course. You can come to my postgraduate course if you want to know that. And factor analysis and Cronbach's and composite reliability both rely on that the indicators that you put into the index are unidimensional measures of one thing and one thing only. Summary of measurement. Important concepts, lack of reliability means that you have some kind of random error. So we want our measures to be repeatable. We want them to be valid so that the measure, the variable that we have, actually measures the construct or concept that we want it to measure. Construct and concept are, by the way, the same thing. Then reliability can be demonstrated empirically with multiple observations. So if we take two observations, two variables that are supposed to measure the same thing, if those two variables are highly correlated, then it means that they are very consistent. So you get always the same result. Like measuring weight with the bathroom scale, you get about the same result every time. So if we measure every one of you twice, the correlation is 0.95 or something, means that the measurement is very reliable. If the scale was contaminated with random measurement error, then two consecutive measurements would be correlated less strongly. The validity is problematic because you can't demonstrate validity. You cannot demonstrate that three questions about satisfaction actually measure satisfaction. We can only demonstrate empirically that they may measure the same thing. And then if we use it over and over and over, and the measure in multiple studies, and the measure has been proven useful in those studies, then maybe it's a valid measure. Then we have some sources of error, some sources of trouble that we may encounter. So let's look at these two constructs, accuracy and completeness again. So we are working with correlations when we do quantitative analysis. There are indicators. I expect government information on government website to be accurate. I expect government websites to provide me with comprehensive government information. Those are, the two indicators are supposed to measure two different things. Are they really? Are they measuring the same thing or two different things? First question on first scale, first question on second scale. They're pretty close to one another, so we may say that maybe there is their claim of discriminant validity while they show it from the data, it's a bit iffy. Of course, there are why those two indicators, this one and that one, are correlated. The authors of the paper want us to believe that they are correlated because both indicators are valid and reliable measurements of two constructs that are related. What else may they measure? They could also measure how hostile the person is toward government. Someone hates government, they will answer, disagree on everything. Everything that the government does is bad. Or they may measure how likely the informant is to respond 1 instead of 5 on a rating scale from 1 to 5. This latter concern is something called method variance, and that is what many papers talk about. And that's it's a concern, but for your master's thesis, you may not necessarily have to be concerned about it. But that's something that something to be aware of, that your data may correlate just because you are asking the same person something at the same point of time with the same scale for it. We have maybe 3 more slides to go. So how do you develop measures? So when you're doing a study, you have to develop a measure. The first thing about developing a new measure is that do not do that. Instead, look through existing research. Has someone already developed a measure and demonstrated that it's a valid and reliable measure? If so, then you use their measure and you save a lot of trouble. Otherwise, we start the measurement process by thinking really hard what really it is that we want to measure, what kind of dimensions it has, and so forth. Then we generate a large, this is about making survey measurements. Then we generate a large number of questions that we could use, so we brainstorm what kind of things we could have. For example, you could end up with 30 questions and then eventually have 5 that you want to use. Then you decide if you're going to be using the agreement scale, 1 to 5, agree to disagree, or perhaps there are some other scale formats, such as presenting a semantic differential, like having one option on the left, another option on the right, and then indicating your preference toward those two options. Then you have the questions, you send them to a colleague or maybe informants. You talk about them, whether they understand the questions. Then you do a pre-study, and then you evaluate the items of the pre-study, and then you actually choose which questions are the best for measuring the thing that you want to do. So that is the scale development process. If you do a proper scale development, it's going to be a bigger project than your master's thesis. So I recommend that you try to stick with questions that have been developed by other people already. If you want to translate, that's okay. I do that all the time. There's a good book about scale development that explains this procedure if you ever have to do it. The measurement relates to the overall research process. So we first have the topic and question. If your question is bad, then it's not worth studying. Then we prepare the research design. We think about what do we need to measure and what is our data going to be. How are we going to do a causal claim, or is it enough to just describe? Then we think about measurement and also what is the sample. So we'll talk about sampling later. Those two contribute to our reliability and measurement validity, which are one of the building stones in quality of quantitative research. If you don't have reliability and validity of measurement, if you do the rest, like rest the statistics really well with bad data, doesn't get you anywhere. So this is like the first thing. If your data are not reliable, it's not very useful. If your data are not valid, it's not very useful. So it's kind of like you have to have all these before you can even think about this. We're going to skip that. The key points from this lecture is that oftentimes we have samples of observed data. We talked about that last time, that we want to use to make inferences about unobserved constructs in the population. The unobserved part is the hard part. Reliability is the degree to which measures are repeatable. If we do the study over, would we get the same result, same measurement result? We can assess reliability by taking multiple independent parallel measures. If those multiple measures correlate highly, it means that they are reliable if they are truly, truly parallel and independent. Cronbach's alpha and factor loading are two of the statistics that we use to quantify. And measurement validity refers to whether indicators measure what they are supposed to measure. The tool that we use for demonstrating validity is factor analysis. We show that indicators that are supposed to measure one thing, they go together and they are clearly separate. They are low loadings on the other factors. For the next lecture, I want you to do a couple of things. We are going to be talking about regression analysis, which is the workhorse of quantitative research. And we have two chapters that talk about analysis and data preparation. So read those, and then you can skim the Venkatesh paper. We'll be going through what does that paper actually present, how do they present regression results, and why. Okay, so we are a bit over time, and if you have any questions, you can ask them now. And bring me the microphones.